Well, good afternoon, and thank you for coming this late today. Over the last few days, last week, there have been many very sophisticated discussions of superconductivity in strongly correlated electron systems. And here I would like to discuss the topic in a more qualitative and empirical way. And it is a continuation of some work that was started some years ago with Philippe Mantou and David Pines. And our goal of that work was basically to try to see if we could identify the parameters, the material-specific parameters, that may be important in uncovering new examples of superconductivity. And so one of our objectives really to show also that there is a multidimensional space of parameters rather than just the characteristic spin fluctuation frequency that I'll discuss later. So in this discussion, the polarizer analyzer model, the standard way of thinking about the pairing interaction, the polarization is not connected with virtual excitation of phonons, but rather of either one of two possibilities, the excitation of crystal field levels for core F electrons in materials like praseodymium, in some cases uranium, or alternatively of virtual excitations within the conduction bands themselves. These are particle hole excitations. And the alternative way of thinking about some of these problems using kinetic superexchange, there isn't an obvious medium in the virtual excitations. But nevertheless, at the end, in both pictures, there emerges an effective intersite spin-spin interaction that is capable, in principle, of producing pairing without phonons, that is, superconductivity without phonons. So this is the introductory point. So probably the example which comes closest to the traditional picture of the exchange of virtual phonons is that of the exchange of magnetic excitons in materials like praseodymium, which has two F electrons in core states. Now, these F electrons do not contribute to the volume of the Fermi surface, but they do greatly modify the quasiparticles, as we'll see in a moment. And in the crystalline electric field, one has in praseodymium a singlet ground state and a doublet magnetic excited state, which in a lattice, due to the intersite exchange interaction, which is anisotropic, this doublet splits up into these two dispersive branches, which are like optical phonons in some sense. But they're all due to electronic degrees of freedom. And the lowest frequency branch, the lowest point, is extremely sensitive to applied strain in the basal plane of the hexagonal structure. And for example, this can be softened to zero with a very tiny applied uniaxial pressure. Pressure within the basal plane of the hexagonal system is shown here, leads to a transition from a paramagnetic state at ambient pressure to an antiferromagnetic state at only a couple of hundred bars. This is almost something you can apply with your hand. This is not a very well-known result. What happens in the antiferromagnetic state, we get an ordering wave vector in the plane, which is also the direction of the magnetization in this case. So this problem has been discussed by people like Peter Fulda and White and others in terms of an SD-type interaction model, an exchange interaction between the localized F electrons and the conduction electrons, characterized by an exchange interaction I. And studies, quantum oscillation studies in this material has shown that what happens as a result of the interaction is the total volume does not actually change, but it is strongly polarized in a magnetic field. There's a large enhancement of the Zeeman splitting arising from I. And there's also a large renormalization of the quasiparticle effective mass. And fairly consistent picture, the value of I, which is needed to explain the Fermi surface polarization in the magnetic field, is of the same order of magnitude as the value which can account for the mass renormalization. But the key point is that over different sheets of the Fermi surface, the mass enhancement varies from about 3 to 8. And this is roughly 30% of that which we saw in the case of uranium platinum 3. And it's a very large enhancement coming just from this coupling to the magnetic exciton, which do not involve a volume change, as is the case in the Kondo effects for the usual case. So this large enhancement, of course, suggests that there may be a strong pairing interaction behind the scenes arising from the exchange of these virtual crystal field excitations. And it's not enough for the mass to be high. It's also crucial that the interaction be strongly Q-dependent, which is also true in this case because of the strong dispersion of the magnetic excitons. But although so far superconductivity has not been seen in this material, then I don't think a really thorough investigation has been carried out. It has been seen in a closely related material, which you will see is close in the sense that uranium, palladium, 2, aluminium, 3 is closely related in the sense that the 3F electrons in the uranium appear that they can be treated as, in terms of two localized F electrons, which form magnetic excitons seen by neutron scattering, plus one itinerant electron, which contributes to the volume of the Fermi surface. And in this case, an analysis by Thalmayer, Zbigniewicz, and others suggests that the crystal field states are similar to the precedanium, although they're both the ground state and the excited state, so it's essentially singlets, I believe. The mass renormalization is quite similar to that of uranium platinum of precedanium, roughly a half of that of uranium platinum 3. And the system is superconducting below 1.8K. And so one might ask, what is the difference between precedanium and this material? And with this, after many discussions with Gertrude Zbigniewicz, we thought that there wasn't a very good explanation at the moment for why precedanium is not actually superconducting. But one point that comes out is that the Fermi surface, in this case, is very strong, very, very closely two-dimensional. This is an F-electron Fermi surface sheet, which is nearly a straight tube, whereas the Fermi surface in precedanium is much more three-dimensional. And there's actually a considerable evidence from microscopic calculations from experiments that the dimensionality of the lattice structure does matter. So for example, in these calculations, which are we are missing the references at the bottom, so unfortunately, these are calculations mainly by Philippe Montu that show that, for example, in the border of anti-ferromagnetism, given that all of the parameters are held constant or equal, there is an improvement of nearly an order of magnitude or more in some cases, in going from a cubic structure to an elongated tetragonal structure. And this is on the theoretical side. There are many other calculations that are come to the same conclusion. But of course, there's also a growing amount of evidence from experiment. For example, in studies, the series of materials with different lattice structure, different magnetic and isotropies, and electronic structures, there's some evidence that as one goes from a cubic structure with a low TC, in this case, cerimidium 3 of about 0.2 Kelvin. And many of the cubic systems are not superconducting at all, so this is already an exceptional case. As one goes from the cubic structure to more and more tetragonal, elongated, two-dimensional structure, TC rises by one or two orders of magnitude. Now, there are, of course, many examples of superconductivity now on the border of antiferromagnetism. Of course, I go back far enough to realize that there was a time when it was the very idea that superconductivity can arise from such non-phononic effects was thought to be outrageous. Now, with all of these examples of the situation, of course, and modern generations see the problem in a very different way. But there are still many problems. For one thing, a search over, starting in the 1970s, for superconductivity on the border of ferromagnetism really struck out for a long time. And we know now from these calculations part of the reason why. And if you see that in blue are the calculations of TC versus the proximity to the quantum magnetic quantum critical points. This is the correlation wave vector squared. that one can have a difference of several orders of magnitude in going from the border of antiferromagnetism to the border of ferromagnetism. And the origin of this again has come up in many different calculations. And the origin of this large difference is actually very simple, we think, although there are actually three or four different effects. But the most important is that the transverse spin fluctuations in the case of triplet pairing and border of ferromagnetism are pair breaking. this type of pair breaking effect can be mitigated, of course, by going from a Heisenberg system, which we have here, to an Ising-like ferromagnet here, where there are only longitudinal spin fluctuations through pairing and no pair breaking transverse fluctuation. And in this case, one can achieve predicted transition temperatures that are approaching that of the best case on the border of antiferromagnetism. So these results, which again came in the effort with Philippe Montu, led us to consider looking at strongly anisotropic ferromagnets. And in Montu Saxena started this with in his PhD studies for the studies looking at uranium ferromagnets with strong anisotropy, starting with uranium germanium 2. These are actually the results shown here for a recent study in uranium cobalt germanium that actually shows the superconductivity forming around a ferromagnetic quantum critical point, both in the ferromagnetic state and in the paramagnetic state. And this is probably the nicest example. Although we've heard of a new and a very interesting example by Joe Thompson early in the week in the uranium 2 platinum carbon 2, which may be in the same family but was not recognized in the early days. The picture that has been proposed for this system is similar to that in uranium palladium 2. The uranium plating to aluminum 3, namely that the three f electrons are taken as forming dual properties, two go into local states, as is in the case of praseodymium, and one goes into band states. And this leads then to pairing interactions fairly complicated, involving a combination of contribution from virtual crystal field excitations in the two localized f electrons, arising from the two localized f electrons, plus, because the f bands, of course, are very narrow, particle hole excitation within the band itself. And so the combination of these two types of interaction has not yet been worked out quantitatively, as far as I know. And so this problem still needs attention from microscopic theory. However, we can avoid this complication by going over to d-metals. And this, in the next example, show results of Eli Reza in the calcium ruthenate, which involves only virtual transition within the conduction electron system, three orbitals of the kind that we've heard discussed several times at this meeting, and in the last lecture in particular. This is actually an antiferromagnetic insulator at zero pressure. It goes into a ferromagnetic state at finite pressure, and then eventually at very high pressure of order 80 kilobars, it goes into a low temperature superconducting state. which might be related to the superconducting state of strontium ruthenate itself. This might be considered something like a negative pressure analog of strontium ruthenate. And so this is interesting in that it can be more readily handled theoretically, because we don't have to worry about the combined crystal field excitation as well as particle hole excitation, the conduction band. And it may give us another example of perhaps a chiral type of superconducting order parameter. But notice that although we have found some examples of superconductivity in the border of ferromagnetism, the ratio of the superconducting transition temperature to the characteristic spin fluctuation temperature I call T star in these slides. And I can say now, right now you could imagine that to be the bandwidth of the lowest relaxational branch of the spin fluctuation spectrum, the entire bandwidth, because you measure by neutron scattering experiments. But T star can be defined in other ways as well, such as from the susceptibility of the entropy. All of the estimates of T star, although there are several different definitions in the literature, they're all within the same orders of magnitude, as far as I'm aware. But we notice that this ratio is tiny, 0.01%. So this is 10 times less than the ratio in helium-3, which is itself very small, compared with that of the systems on the border of antiferromagnetism, which is, which I should say, the optimal systems on the border of antiferromagnetism in quasi-2-dimensional, where this ratio is about 10%. And that, again, that number varies depending on your choice of definition for T star, but it's very high and getting approaching 1, essentially, in some cases. Now, this graph, of course, is, I'm sure all of you realize, very misleading, because if I were to put all of the known materials, I would find most of them would fall on this horizontal line right here, where there's a high T star, but in fact are not superconducting. And maybe one of the most dramatic examples is chromium, where T star is about 10 to the 4, and no superconductivity has yet been seen down to maybe 10 mK at the critical pressure where chromium becomes paramagnetic, which is about 110, 120 kilobars. So what this means is that the superconducting TC should be plotted on a multidimensional space, again, not surprising to any of you. And that what we're seeing here is the selection of the peaks in this multidimensional space projected onto one variable, T star. And one of our goals is to find out what the important dimensions actually are. So we know that very low ratios, TC ratios, arise in cubic systems as compared with tetragonal systems, and on the border of ferromagnetism. So these are two directions, so to speak, where you fall off the peaks and go into very relatively low TCs, low compared with T star. These two cases I have just described, and the findings are compatible or consistent with the microscopic theories, as far as we can tell. They're not obvious mysteries, though they may be if we look more carefully at the problem. But there are a few cases that remain, it seems to me, very mysterious. For example, the ytterbium system, which are analogs of the cerium systems, there are very many ytterbium systems on the border of magnetism that are not superconducting. And in fact, a search extending over several decades has so far led only to two examples that I'm aware of superconductivity in incompletely filled F-shells and ytterbium compounds. And one of them is ytterbium aluminium boron 4, which was studied by Nakasugi and co-workers. And the other, which we heard about yesterday, is in ytterbium rhodium 2 silicon 2, which is a dramatic superconducting transition down in the millikelvin range, very low millikelvin range, approaching microkelvin. And although we do have, you can say, two examples now in a field with hundreds of candidates. But notice that the TC ratio is very tiny. In this case, for ytterbium, aluminum, boron, 4, it's the same as helium 3. So the ratio of TC in the superfluid helium 3 to the characteristic spin fluctuation temperatures is about the same. Whereas in this case, it's still an order of magnitude smaller, and this is more akin to the very low TCs that we found in the calcium ruthenate. So this has been a puzzle which none of the sort of theoretical discussions I've given you so far offers a reasonable explanation. Now, yesterday we heard the lecture by Rebecca Flint, where she gave a possible and exotic, actually, explanation for why superconductivity may be absent in the ytterbium system. And it's tied up with the idea of composite pairing, which I still have to learn about, I confess. But that idea, I understand, does not carry over to the magnetic interaction that I've been talking about here. So in order to understand why the magnetic interactions themselves are not working, we need to look beyond that point, I think. And I refer here to basically a suggestion made by Pierre Coleman and Alexei Selik, that unfortunately appear right here. I apologize, I'm not sure what happened. And the suggestion goes something like this, that normally we think of, we tend to think of the doublet state for the F electron, forgetting about, it's argued, all of the multiplets, because the crystal field splitting separate out all the doublets, essentially. But that actually turns out to be a very misleading idea. So let's just see what actually happens in practice if you apply the RG theory to the Kondo ladder, to the Kondo problem. The expression for the Kondo temperature is normally given in this form, where J is the Kondo interaction parameter, exchange interaction parameter. Rho is the density of states. D is the inverse density of states, approximately. That is the bandwidth. That in the presence of degeneracy of the orbitals, of the F orbitals, and crystal field splitting, we have to modify this standard expression by this factor here. The proof is a very beautiful proof is given in Pierce's textbook on many body effects. And this factor involves a ratio of the energy scale for the conduction electron of order, the bandwidth or so for the conduction, where the RG process begins. And all these states below D contribute to the renormalization of the Kondo interaction. And delta X is the crystal field splitting between the low-lying doublet, for example, in cerium, or the two or the top of the bands in the ytterbium, from the remaining crystal field levels assumed to be degenerate for simplicity. So there's only one parameter, though in general there will be a number of parameters here. And then Tk is down here. So in the limit where, which is the normal case, where the Kondo temperature is below the typical crystal field splitting, which is well below the typical bandwidth of the system, under this condition we get this factor, which involves also the degeneracy n of the states that are separated by the spin orbit interaction. So that is, for the cerium, n would be 6, corresponding to the 5 halves states separated by the spin orbit interaction from the 7 half, J 7 half states, which gives an n of 8 for ytterbium. So because n appears in the exponent, the effect is non-negligible. There's another point, which is that the crystal field splitting tend to be weaker in the ytterbium system than in the cerium system, because the orbitals, the F orbitals in the ytterbium system tend to be more closely bound to the core, to the nucleus. And so what we have is a larger N here and a smaller delta here for the ytterbium system, giving us a difference in this factor in going from cerium to ytterbium of between 10 and 100. This is not a small difference between the two types of material. And if you follow this, this is the key point in circle here, but if you follow the consequences of this, what you find is that this leads to a reduced critical value of the Kondo coupling at the border of anti-Fermiotism. So a reduced critical value at the quantum critical point, which then implies a smaller interchange inter-site interaction and a lower TN and a lower supernet TTC, all compatible with experiment. I will now make just one brief comment before I put, before I give the conclusion, which is that accompanying magnetic interactions on the border of anti-ferromagnetism, it frequently charge instability, or we find frequently charge instability nearby. And it turns out that in some cases, these charge instabilities work in tandem and coherently with the spin instability to enhance the superconducting transition temperature. This is another parameter in this multi-dimensional space I've been talking about that has to do with the additional contribution of charge fluctuations near to spin instabilities. And this has been checked out and confirmed by experiment and theory in the case of cerium copper 2 silicon 2. Now, this idea of charge interaction in this case involves local charge interaction, which is a redistribution of the charge density over the unit cell or over the cerium or ytterbium molecule or atom. If you could somehow spread out the charge inhomogeneities more widely, you might expect even larger effects from charge fluctuations. And this is indeed what happens, this is my last slide, it's indeed what happens in the case of polar materials on the border of ferroelectricity, where one finds, again, superconductivity emerging at the edge of ferroelectricity in doped strontium titanate. And what is interesting about this problem is that this superconductivity survives at densities that are up to six orders of magnitude lower than normal metallic densities. That implies very low density of states for the conduction electrons. To get superconductivity with such low density of states, one needs a humongous interaction. And that interaction is coming from the polar modes, basically the naked charges that are widely separated in space, relatively speaking. So that brings me to a concluding slide, which is just to repeat the point that there is this multidimensional space that determines TC, and understanding this enables us to search, to identify and search for superconductivity in new materials. On top of the need for a high characteristic spin fluctuation temperature and to be on the border of a metallic state, we find that also and the lattice anisotropy is important, and quasi-2D is, generally speaking, more favorable than a quasi-2D. Also, anti-ferromagnetism or uniaxial ferromagnetism, Heisenberg ferromagnetism, tend to be favored over Heisenberg-type ferromagnetism. And we also found in the case of the ytterbium system the important role of degeneracies, which makes it maybe the distinguishing characteristics between the cerium and the ytterbium systems. And then finally, although this is certainly not a complete list of important parameters in a multidimensional space, is the notion that the charge coupling that tends to be around magnetic instabilities should be compatible as much as possible with the magnetic interactions, and that this happens in the case of cerium copper 2 silicon 2, probably in a number of other systems, and in particular, the iron selenide strontium titanate interfaces we heard about at this meeting. And so, if I were to choose one question about around this problem, is to wonder if using the engineering strategy we heard about yesterday in Kim's lecture, if one could consider tuning a system both to the border of anti-ferromagnetism, but also anti-ferroelectricity, as opposed to ferroelectricity, because anti-ferroelectricity is less effectively screened by the added conduction electrons and may survive intact up to high densities. Thank you very much.
Oh, that was very illuminating, Gil. Another issue is, of course, the question whether the mechanisms you propose qualify for a retarded interaction, which is essential to BCS. So the question perhaps would be, chromium is just doesn't meet that retarded interaction criterion. And the question I have is, how about the mechanism you suggest, the crystal field excitations?
I'm sorry. I had trouble hearing this point. Could you go over the main point of your question? Yeah, I didn't.
I can't hear anything either.
Oh. Okay, so I try again. So the main ingredients point you didn't mention was the issue of retarded interactions that is essential to BCS theory. Mm-hmm. The question was, two questions actually. Could it be that chromium is just, the T star is just too high to actually meet this retarded interaction criterion? And the second question was, at the very beginning, you talked about the crystal field excitations. The question just is the retardedness criterion met in these materials for the crystal field excitations?
Yeah, I understand it very clearly. So, first of all, in most of the cases we considered, and in the theoretical models that I indicated, the retardation is not the key result. It is called space avoidance mechanism for pairing. So the retardation is a time avoidance mechanism, which is very important in the case of phonons. But in the case of spin fluctuation, it's actually the fact that the interaction is off-site. That's the crucial point. The retardation, so when we in fact noticed interestingly that in the TJ model there is actually no retardation at all. Of course there is in a more realistic model. It is actually the fact that the interaction is non-local in space. So in the case of phonons, the interaction, simple phonon mechanisms, not all, the interaction tends to be relatively local in space and therefore has to be non-local in time to make sure that the electrons don't come at the same site at the same time, and that would then feel a strong repulsion. But when the interaction is on neighboring sites, then this condition of retardation is not as crucially important. And so we can check, actually, in the numerical calculation that if you turn off the retardation, you get similar results in almost all the cases. Chromium, so going back to your point about chromium, I think what your point maybe translates to is that this curve TC versus T star may actually come down at high, and I agree with you. I think that's what happened. Yeah, that curve, nothing goes up forever, and it goes up and eventually comes down because what happens is that, I think that's the right explanation for chromium. What happens is that you get this large energy range, but you get a very low mass renormalization. In fact, so small it hasn't even been measured. And that means that there's a small number in the exponent at the bottom of the exponent 1 over lambda, which is much more important than the large number in front. Yep, I agree with that.
So, Gil, you have down there anti-ferroelectric. What do you mean by an anti-ferroelectric and why would this?
Okay, so I'm told. So, that's a question I'd like to ask myself. But working with people in the field, Jim Scott, for example, is an expert in this, has identified system they call anti-ferroelectrics. So I think the important point is that the phonon modes, the optical phonon modes, are strongly polar, which means they involve charge separation. So that's what's important, I think, in these systems, is that normally phonons are involved in the motion of neutral atoms to first approximation. So you might even wonder, why are we getting electron-phonon interaction? Well, of course, it's because the electron penetrate the atom or induce a polarization on the atom. But here we're talking about naked charges separated in space. And I think that's really important. We think that quantitatively we can show that the strontium titanate, that's what produces this huge interaction. It is the fact that the electron come in and see naked charges, which means you see the full E squared over R interaction. Put it differently, the deformation potential, if you wanted to write it in the language of Frohlich Hamiltonian, is the maximum that it can possibly be. I think that's the thing. I think Larkin understood this many years ago. I think in the early paper he said you have to think of ionicity, and that's the origin of strong superconductivity. And we see it in the case of strontium titanate. Now, the problem is that for the ferroelectrics, when you start adding an electron, you begin to screen out the low Q modes up to the screening length. They're no longer naked. And so the interaction comes down. So TC, which has a beautiful start, ends up coming straight down again. So we're thinking, if we could move these polar modes to finite Q and beat the screening outside the screening length, we can keep these polar interactions there up to higher temperatures, or higher doping levels, and therefore higher temperatures. We're trying to, this is a speculation at this point, so we're just going to try it and see if it works.
If we look at magnesium diboride, which is the highest phonon superconductivity around, I mean, there it seems that we have a small group of electrons interacting with a small part of the Fermi surface interacting with a very specific high-frequency phonon, which is this interplane stretching mode.
Yeah. I'm wondering, is that actually a polar mode as well?
What?
I'm wondering if that, in the terminology I'm using, that is actually a polar mode, which involves charge separation, not just displacements of neutral atoms, but I don't know in detail about that, but I know that in barium, potassium, and the BKBO, the modes that are, that in Kohlner's calculation, the modes that seem to be producing superconductivity are polar modes. They're charges, naked charge, moving around near the center of the Brillouin zone. No, I'm sorry, away from the center of the Brillouin zone. And these are the modes that would get very strong coupling, I think.
Yeah, but once, but that case, barium, bismuth oxide, you end up, you know, getting some kind of charge density.
Yeah, yes, yes.
And the phonons, using the phonons in that way, they seem to just want to form a classical crystal. They're not really so quantum, right?
I think maybe these antiferroelectrons may not be so different from charge density waves system. Although they use different language, I'm wondering if in the end it's that different from charge.
There has been an interesting suggestion by Warren Pickett that maybe you could generalize magnesium diboride in that in magnesium diboride you have one specific small piece of the Fermi surface connected strongly to one specific high frequency phonon. But if you could engineer a material where you had more pockets and each pocket contributed to or interacted strongly with a different phonon, that this way you could add these attractions together and get a much stronger superconductivity without getting into the trap that the crystal itself has to reorganize and the crystal becomes unstable,
right,
which is the usual thing that stops you from getting too strong a phonon.
That's a really nice picture.
But you have this idea, but how to realize it is another matter.
Yeah, I understand. But I just want to make a comment about the small pockets. They are quasi-two-dimensional, so the density in space is not falling down as it would be in a three-dimensional case. So although they're small, their density in space is high. And also, these optical phonons you're describing, the crucial question is what are the deformation potential for them? So that means how naked are the charges that are involved. If they're neutral charges, then the deformation potential will be weak. But if they're actually polar the polar optical modes with separated well-defined unscreened charges, and you can get very, very large deformation potential. So I would say that being in two dimension is important because these pockets near the zone boundary that couple strongly the phonons do not have a low density of states. If you go to 3D and try to do that, you get small density of states, pockets, bad. And so combining two dimensions, modes, Fermi surfaces close to the zone boundary coupled strongly to phonon, but not too close to the zone boundary because there are Goldstone modes and problems. And then on top of that, this deformation potential, I think it's hidden in the calculation. It would be nice to pull this crucially important point out more intuitively to see what makes the difference. And I'm arguing that the difference is the degree to which these are polar modes.
Want to, in BCS theory, the high frequency of the phonons plays a crucial role, no?
Yeah, so that's another issue. If it's too high a frequency, then you're looking for attraction at very high frequency.
Well, and that's what you get in magnesium diboride, no?
Yeah, that's true, but again, it's a balance, right? If you go too high up, then the master normalization will be too weak. So there's some Goldilocks effect, not too high, not too low, yeah. But I think, actually, the main thing I've learned in this problem is that it would be nice if these numerical calculations could be interpreted to give us an intuitive idea, which would make it easier to select materials. And of course, that's what you've done and what you just said a moment ago.
Gail, I had a question about the plutonium-based superconductors, which from F-electron perspective is very high TC.
Ah, yeah, the plutonium.
And I wonder how that fits into the way you think.
That's because that material has two advantages from our perspective. One is that it's quasi-T-dimensional, so there's highly anisotropic Fermi surfaces. But equally, if not more important, it has very high spin fluctuation temperature, T star. 10 times higher than in the cerium system. So it makes sense, you know, the 0.2 to 2 to 20 follows quite naturally from the model I've been discussing. If you take into account the increased bandwidth of the spin fluctuations in that material.
In several cases, you plotted TC versus T star. How T star was determined for every particular case? What is?
So the difference between T star and
how the temperature was measured? How you get the number?
Oh yeah, okay. So, so in the plot that I showed you, in fact, it was obtained from the linear heat capacities. But of course, so it gives you an effective Fermi temperature. This of course cannot be used if you're really close to a quantum critical point because the heat capacity tends to be logarithmically divergent. Another way that it's been used is to look at the temperature at which the entropy changes by getting close to something like 50% of the disordering entropy R log 2 for a doublet. The other way, which I find, which in fact Maria used, was essentially the full bandwidth of the low-lying dissipative spin fluctuation mode. Now that mode has a bandwidth, and it has also, at the origin, an energy scale which vanishes at the quantum critical point. So there are two energy scales, one that vanishes at the critical point, one that remains more or less constant. That's the T star in that model. And all of these values turn out to be within a factor of 2 or 3 of each other.
Any other questions? Well, thank you. If they haven't been thanked enough, you may want to thank the organizers.
Thank you, Gil. Just a few things to say. First of all, I hope you've all enjoyed this meeting. We think that bringing together the different aspects of the field of superconductivity gives us great new contrast. And I was just thinking back, I arrived in Santa Barbara as a postdoc 30 years ago. And in those days, we had about 3 superconductors that we knew were electronic, or we believed were electronic. And it's astonishing that we have hundreds and hundreds now. In those days, there was a very well-known theorem that, just like cars will never go faster than 60 miles an hour, that superconductors will never go above 25 Kelvin. And that's been blasted to all hell, not enough yet. But I think we're really only at the beginning of all of this. And I think that by becoming experts at the field, knowing the other branches of superconductivity, as I listened to the talks on the pseudo-gap physics, reveling in our diversity whilst using it as a strength rather than a weakness, I think is very important. With that, I'm just going to say and ask Peter to make one small announcement connected with Chicago. But thank you for all coming. Thank the staff. Go home and think hard about superconductors. There's a lot more work to be done. Okay.
We would be remiss if we didn't also thank the KITP staff who helped us make this such a successful event. It's really wonderful working here because everything works like clockwork without having to do very much as an organizer. So in particular, John Berlinski is here, and I don't know if Greg Huber is here, probably not, but those two associate directors helped us a lot. And of course the staff, in particular Jesse Long, who was the main KITP staff person helping us out. So maybe we can have a little round of applause for them as well. Thank you. I don't know if all of you have heard about the incident in Chicago. There's a fire in the airport today, and it may have messed up air traffic around the country, despite the fact that I understand that planes are flying again. So if your flight has been canceled and you need to spend another day with us, I checked with Jesse, and Best Western has 10 more rooms, so we should be able to accommodate you, and we'll all go out to dinner and celebrate the fire. Okay? So thank you very much, everybody.